To start this meeting of the Economic Development and Planning Scrutiny Committee this evening, it's reached 6:30 and we start with minutes of the last meeting, which was 18th of December. Has anybody got any comments, any observations, any alterations? Can I sign them? Thank you. Minutes.
Sorry.
Item one. Apologies.
Councillor Edgeley substituted by Councillor Jones and Councillor Loughran substituted by Councillor Hobbs.
Thank you very much. Next one is public question time nil. Councillor session nil. Members' items. We go straight over to Doug and the update from the Task and Finish Working Group on the evening of evening.
So the Task and Finish Group met on a date which escapes me entirely. We discussed kind of a work plan for the Task and Finish Group to kind of try to update for subs. It's on the evening economy, and so it's we're looking at kind of a wide range of different stakeholders within the evening economy, so users as well as business owners who are directly involved in the evening economy, indirectly involved in the evening economy, might develop into working in the evening economy. And we set out a work plan and gave most of, but not all, the members of the committee some work to do. We were mindful of the substitution, so we didn't, you have quite a few. But a number of people have already reported back. So we have already got a number of different interviews that have taken place, which have got some really interesting feedback. In addition to that, the County Council are also undertaking work in a similar area. I've been sent a presentation of the kind of their work plan and what they are looking at. Their timeline for delivery is much longer than the one we've set out in our work plan. Ours was deliberately like quite short to try and encourage us to get the work done and get it back in. I think we're probably already behind on what we said in our work plan, but I think that was part and parcel of kind of the way in which it works. In terms of the work that has been submitted back to me so far, if you have anything that you have collected and have not sent back in, excellent, well done for finding that information and collecting it thus far. Please do send it in so I can bring everything together. From what we have had back so far, there's quite a wide range of different areas which they have which stakeholders have identified, some of which sit outside of the purview of the borough, and it's probably a good thing that the county are looking at it, because there are a number of things which are county responsibilities, buses, that kind of thing. But within the purview of the borough, things like and more than one person's identified a tension between greater residential development in the town centre and the evening economy kind of more broadly, which was something that we raised in our discussions through the Task and Finish Group. They talked about great clarity, coordination and speed of decision making in kind of across different licensing areas. I think those are probably, there's a number of kind of specific individual things, but those are things which have come up more than once from different stakeholders. That's an overview of where we are. Happy to answer any questions.
Thanks very much. If anybody hasn't produced the piece of work, and it's not onerous, it would be really helpful if you could actually get it to Doug as soon as possible, because there are, it makes it an unbalanced piece of work if we don't have the contributions from everybody. And it would be very good if we could have everybody's contribution without pointing any fingers at anyone. be useful.
Madam Chair, I've spoken to Doug.
And we know you've been in Australia.
I've been in Oz, but we spoke about what he was looking for me to do, and I have made some inroads into doing that, and I hope to get it by the end of this month.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And I'm in the same position. I mean, I'm just as bad as anybody because I've been moving house.
Yeah, just to say the town centre thing, I didn't know, but my name was on there to look into it, but it was folded 4 years ago. The committee was, which you were on.
The town centre partnership?
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, it's folded 4 years ago. But I've got a meeting on Tuesday at 10 past.
No, it was reformed chairman, but
with
Mary Walker as the
yes,
chair.
Yes, it was.
But I believe it has failed talking to some of the shopkeepers in town. Seem to think it's gone by the wind.
Right.
I've got a meeting on Tuesday anyway. So,
so you might find
I
out what's going on.
That, yeah.
I'd like to thank the chairman for allowing me to do my survey, because it I ended up having a cake and a cup of tea with in the soup kitchen with the owner there.
Oh, we might find you another one then.
No, well, I'll go anywhere. As anyway, I mean, Alex, anywhere for a cup of tea and a cake, you know me.
Okay.
I don't know if it's relevant, but at community wellbeing last night, we had a report from the police about Stafford at night, and you know that the taxi marshals and all the different sort of stakeholders that are there trying to prevent antisocial behaviour. It might be relevant to what you're doing. And there was a presentation by her, which I think, Jackie, you're sending it out on.
I've circulated it to members that were at the committee last night.
So
you
might want to see that. I don't know. It might be relevant.
Yeah, one of the things we've tried to do is not focus on the antisocial behaviour aspect of it, because one of the reasons why the task force group started in the first place is because we quite consistently see the evening economy in the context of the question of safety. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that safety is not important.
Yeah.
It's something that's coming up, that has come up in the conversation and will continue to come up, so it may well be relevant.
Well, it might be worth casting
absolutely.
An eye over.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, absolutely. But it's mm-hmm. the attempt to try and include it as an economic driver as much as possible.
Through your chair, have you had a response from Michelle? So I shouldn't be here either. I should have been in Australia, but it was cancelled. So I asked her to respond to you, and I don't know if she had. No, I'll take that.
Okay. When are we going to bring this back? Because it's part of Task and Finish. Will we have another Task and Finish meeting, do you think, Doug?
My feeling was that I would try and get more information back in, then have a meeting where that is summarised and people can look at the kind of raw information as well, so they can see that the summary, which I've done, is fair.
Should we set some timelines?
Yes.
Tonight. Try again.
Yes. I'm trying to think. Thank you. Probably after I look at everything in school holidays, and I'm probably the only person in the room who looks at everything in school holidays.
How dare you?
I mean, after the Easter break, so the week after the Easter weekend, so we're doing the 13th of April, so that's full council on the Wednesday. It'd be good to do it that week.
Okay, and give us a date.
15th.
Right, everybody, Jackie will send a note out to say that we need all reports back by the week before the 15th,
yep.
Whatever that date is going to be.
So
can you
be
set a date, Jackie, for us? Because Doug will be putting the whole paper together on the 15th. Ready for consideration by the committee with its
April
recommendations.
April.
Yeah. Yeah, we've gone past the March date. Okay. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Thanks so much for your work, Doug, as well. That moves us on now to the officer's report, starting with quarter three. Is that you, Dean?
Yes, Chair. Sorry. Thank you. Okay, so usual quarterly performance report, obviously at the end of quarter three. You'll see that quite a number of the actions in the priority delivery plan have been completed now. As is usual with these reports, Chair,
they're all out of date.
Yes, I was going to say they're kind of backward looking, not forward looking. So if things do move on, we produce the reports, we present them to cabinet scrutiny, and things move on. But obviously, provides you a bit of a snapshot. So, do you want to take it page by page? Obviously, the front page is just summary of successes and slippage. We've moved into the main part of the report. Obviously, take.
Where are you at?
Page four.
Oh, he's got a different shape, that's why.
Yeah, it came out in portrait.
Got it.
Start with page four,
absolutely.
Okay. So, in terms of the Stafford Town Centre transformation work, the main demolition works within the town centre have now been completed, largely complete. Obviously, the former Guildhall Shopping Centre and the Co-op. So, obviously, walked around town recently, you'll see a lot of demolition work has taken place and the sites have been cleared in anticipation of redevelopment. As indicated in the report there, the next stage is to agree the development delivery route for those cleared sites. So we are currently finalising what we've called Town Centre Development Framework, which will set out the proposals for the cleared sites. And that is intended to come to Cabinet in April. So I suggest, Chair, that the committee may want to look at that at its next meeting.
Yes, and we can't set the agenda for the next meeting, so if we could put it as a
future item, yeah.
Should go on that. Is that all right? Are you happy with that?
My phone never stops ringing because there's nobody working on the sites anymore.
That's because the works are finished.
In the town centre itself?
The demolition. The main demolition works are now complete. We will be, in the next few weeks, doing some further demolition works. There's the old Wilco site, and then there's some units, 10 to 12 Jailgate Street, that are on the corner of the old Co-op site. So we've obviously got to secure planning permission before we move forward with those works. But the main demolition works, the Guildhall and the Co-op, are largely complete now, so there's no one on the site because the work's done.
All the buildings are down.
There's some buildings that will be done as part of this further demolition that I've just mentioned.
Because they moved all the boats and everything off the site, and there's all them buildings are knocked down.
There are a few remaining structures that need to come down. So those will be dealt with as part of this further demolition. But the main demolition works are complete.
Is that the Blue Cross building and the dance studio? Is that the two that's got to come down?
Yeah. So you've got those corner units. Yeah. And the former Wilco. So we've got a planning application in for that at the moment, and obviously subject to that being consented.
My phone never stops. Where are we going to have a public toilet and you have to close that down?
Well, the public toilet's still there on
the
Wilco site, so we are looking at those. There aren't any imminent plans to demolish them. We will obviously be progressing the demolition of the Wilco building once we've secured planning, but we do need to consider public toilets. The proposal will be going forward within the redevelopment that we will put facilities there for people, but obviously there are those toilets there at the moment which will remain in situ.
Yeah, that's through you again, Kevin. That's one thing I'm getting phone calls and complaints about, is the loss of those toilets.
Should we ask Cabinet to address that, to take that on board?
Chair,
from this committee.
Yeah.
Would that be all right, Frank? Ask Cabinet to look at it. Just to make sure it's going.
There's one hotel, the manager rang me the other day, and he says there's people just using their toilet now all the time. They don't spend any money in there, they just come and use the toilet because they said there's no public toilet.
Chair, that's okay.
Yep.
So, yeah.
That's okay. The Cabinet members noted it.
Yeah, absolutely. Chairman, it's not just a Swan Hotel. I mean, coffee number one, where I drink my coffee. People walking in and out there all the time. I've been told that there's a toilet there going in. So we need these public toilets.
I thought there was an agreement that public houses would allow people to go in and use their toilets. Because I think, I remember Gillian Pardisi bringing this up quite a while ago, do you remember? And they looked at, you know, the lack of public toilets. and then she spoke to officers, and they said there was an agreement that places like the Swan would allow people to use their public toilets.
Yeah, they had a through you chair, they had a rate or whatever, some rebate on their council tax or something.
Perhaps we could ask the cabinet to have a look at that as well.
Gillian would remember, wouldn't she?
Do you have an answer to that?
I'm committed to public toilets in our towns, Stone, Eccleshall, Stafford. We shouldn't be relying on private companies and their toilets. And if it's too much for them, if they are seeing an increase in it because of something we've done, absolutely we will take a look at what we're doing and make sure that that sticks. But the redevelopment, when that comes, we will have public convenience position as part of that. So even if we end up knocking those down, we will need to make sure there is a replacement for them in some suitable location. So that's what we're looking at, but the plans, that's what this year's about.
Yeah, that's reassuring.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It's not really an answer, but it's a commitment. Is that good enough?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll come back to it in a few months' time. We'll bring it back in a few months' time, whenever. At the moment, we'll say November. How they're getting on.
If I may just ask one question. When the wider master plan does come forward, do we see that as sort of artist's illustrations, or do we see it as a plan that says this is what it will look like? How do you envisage it?
Thank you, Chair. Well, obviously that detail will be presented to Cabinet very shortly, but I'd expect a combination of, it won't just be text, we will be putting forward some visuals, we'll put forward some proposals, but that obviously will be going to Cabinet, and then obviously Chair, Committee can have a look at that and scrutinise it.
Yes, I think we've put a plan in to see it, look at it in July when we have our next meeting.
And some open spaces as well.
So I was told it was likely to be a high-level plan, which I'm not sure that is good. High-level means rather abstract in the ether, but we shall see.
Brings life into the town.
Exactly. Dee, did you have...
Not mine.
No, right. Okay.
Okay.
Move on.
Okay. In terms of...
Around the table.
Stafford Station Gateway, not much else to progress on that. Chair, we are looking to acquire a piece of land as part of that project. We've not been able to conclude that as yet, so that's reflected in the report. Again, Chair, I would suggest we bring that back to a future meeting, perhaps with a supporting paper and report. Obviously, I'm not allowed to say too much in here at the moment because it's subject. Yeah, probably the autumn, but hopefully, I'll have a bit more detail by then.
Do we have a September meeting?
We don't know the dates yet.
I haven't got the dates yet.
But usually there's one in September.
Yes, at the beginning of July, so it will be September, October.
So we could bring it back in September, October. You should have some information by then.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, move on to page 6. Delivery of planning services to enable economic growth. National planning policy framework assessment and new local plan implications. So officers have just responded to the national planning policy framework NPPF consultation by the deadline, so we've set out our views on that, on those proposals.
Where can we see those?
We can circulate those.
I think that'd be useful.
We can circulate them. Looking at Jenny sitting at the back, we can.
Jenny will circulate them.
Do that, Jenny. Yep.
I will circulate.
Okay.
Thank
you. Yep. And obviously, we're just assessing at the moment the implications in terms of the new local plan timetable. The local plan regulations have now been published, and I think the intention is that Alex will come to a meeting to present an updated position.
I think he's coming in July.
Yeah.
There's future meeting.
So we'll again be able to come back with a bit more detail on what it all means and the timetable and the next steps. Okay, in terms of the development management team, we're still progressing the improvement plan as indicated in the report. It is taking a bit longer than we would like. We have seen over the last few months quite an increase in the workload and the demand being placed on the planning service. There's been a number of planning applications coming into the team, which has placed further pressure. We have brought some interim resource into the team to support the workload, to enable the team to still have the capacity to do the improvement plan. We have got a number of work streams, Chair, that we're progressing around that, particularly around validations, speeding up decisions, developing a customer charter, but also how we can better utilise our IT system, and there is some work underway to look at that. It is a real challenge. We would like to be a bit more advanced, but obviously, as I said, there are a few headwinds that we're contending with, but again, we'll be more than happy to bring a detailed report back to the committee.
We need to bring a paper back because with great respect, it's sort of going backwards rather than forwards at the moment. As I understand, the workload's increased substantially, but yeah. the timelines for validation are lagging quite badly, aren't they? So I don't know, again, it's going to be very full this autumn meeting. July's too soon, presumably, is it, Dean?
We could try and provide an interim update in July.
Would you do that?
Yeah. Because it is important.
Yeah.
I think, Chair, you are right. We've made progress in some areas, but unfortunately on validations, it is taking longer now. So we need a bit of time to put in place. It isn't just about resource, but it's about looking at process. It's looking at how we can work more efficiently. So hopefully in the next meeting, we'll make a bit of progress on that. And then perhaps in the autumn, we can bring a more detailed overview of where we are.
Frank,
I've been dealing with three cases just lately, and the one is on the extra road. They sent the letters on the 19th of January and they never had a response, so I've tried to sort that out today again. And also Redline Farm at Orton, that's taken months, and these people are just getting fed up. They think there's nothing happening, and what disappoints me, and it's not a criticism because I know since COVID people work from home, but you come in the planning office, there's nobody there. Perhaps two, three people. Is that causing a problem for us? People working from home?
Sure, I think in my view, no. I think, you know, hybrid working is quite well established now. Obviously we encourage officers to come into the office one or two days a week. There will be some days you come in and the office is full. You may come in a day where there are mainly people working from home. Obviously we're trying to give officers the opportunity to get their heads into quite large caseloads at the moment and avoid distractions, so giving them home working opportunities enables that. I do think it's important that they come into the office though, particularly for team meetings and to review cases, and particularly our younger officers, it is beneficial for them to be around the more senior experienced officers. So I think it is a hybrid, and that's certainly the approach that we're taking at the moment. And I know the team are coming into the office. I think Wednesday seems to be a day when most or if everybody is in, but
that's
perhaps we can review that as well. But it is about trying to strike a balance. I think if everybody came back into the office tomorrow, I don't think it would materially change anything. I think there'd be a lot more distractions for people. But the service does need to be visible and contactable, and we do need to look at that customer care. And as I said, Chair, that is one of the work streams that
progressing. Being able to, for members to be able to get hold of planning officers is always a complete nightmare.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Lewis. I've got Peter next.
I was just going to say, I know other departments are losing staff. How's the planning department coping with losing staff?
We have lost some people over the last sort of couple of years, but I would say at the moment we've got a reasonably stable team. You know, we've managed to give some development opportunities to some of the younger officers who've come in as planning assistants and they've progressed through to senior. they've attained their RTPI accreditation. So there is a real, there's a core group of officers there who've been with the council for quite a long time and actually really committed.
And then the second is, are there any outside people we have to bring in?
We are having to bring some external people in at the moment, particularly say agents. It is, but it's a balance because obviously the work needs to be done.
Of course.
If you create too many additional permanent staff, that's obviously a cost that the council has to bear. And if the workload was to go down, then obviously that cost is the same. So we're trying to manage those peaks and troughs. We have brought in some additional agency staff recently. Obviously, planning is a fee-earning service, and we do generate planning income. And we are working to try and reinvest some of that income into the team.
I mean, I appreciate that many of the staff we've had in the past don't necessarily live in the town, but people who you rent, if you rent from somewhere else, they won't know the area at all. So I think that's a bad thing, but that's a personal thing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, the working from home, do you set targets on how many applications they have to achieve, and is it monitored?
They
don't just switch on the my daughter worked in the public service at Cheltenham, and some of her staff she knows just used to switch on the computer. I don't know if they have a device or something, but she used to complain she couldn't monitor actually what her staff was up to, even though it showed that their computer was logged on all day.
The chair, as part of the improvement project, we have introduced, or we are introducing, performance frameworks. We're making sure that team leaders all the way down to planning assistants have got clear targets. They've got clear expectations about what they need to do and what they should be doing. I'm encouraging the development manager and the team leaders to actively monitor workloads, caseloads and support officers and make sure that performance runs right across the service. We are under we're in very challenging time at the moment. It's really difficult. The workloads are increasing, but I think we've got a very hard-working, committed team. They're doing their level best, but we're not quite where we would want to be, but we are striving to improve. So hopefully, Chair, we can come back in the autumn with a more substantive update, but it is difficult, but we are trying our best. So.
Thank you.
Well, I think there's been research done into home working, and the evidence shows that people actually work harder and are more productive working from home. There's that sort of body of research now. And I from my experience, you know, my daughter and her husband work, I mean, they work so hard. And then they do travel into work one day a week, you know, when they're actually working.
Yeah. But I think, Joe, we have tried to make sure that particularly the agency staff are coming into the office, you know, not every day, but trying to come in. We've had situations where they are in other parts of the country and it's difficult, but I think more recently when we're actually interviewing them, we are saying, look, we want you to come into the office one or two days a week. We want you to be visible and be part of the team. But, you know, we've talked about it previously that it is a very, very difficult, it is a difficult market at the moment. People are able to move around, and particularly they can work in the private sector, they can work in agency, where they could probably work from home 5 days a week. So that's why I'm saying we have to get the balance, because if we move too far back, people will say, well, we'll move somewhere else.
Yeah.
But equally, as I say, we do need visibility and people to be in. And perhaps we just need to give that a bit of thought about how we can communicate that to members. Because as I say, if you're turning up one day and no one's there, maybe we just need to have that kind of visibility around which days of the week actually are best if you do want to pop in. So I can have a look at that, Chair.
Yep, that'd be another action.
Probably because I'm used to hybrid working, I don't tend to turn up and expect someone to be there, because that's my day job is hybrid working. So I just email people and get very fast responses, and if I need to have an actual conversation, I'm able to set those up via email with officers on planning
teams,
and have had no issues with that whatsoever. So just to say that I haven't had any issues with it, but it's likely because I'm used to working in that way.
You're going to give a report at a future meeting anyway on how the services progressing?
Yeah.
Dean. Just one question from me then. Full introduction of the chargeable pre-app service. Question is, how's it going and when are you going to extend it to commercial businesses?
So at the moment, Chair, as you indicate, we offer pre-applications for all householder applications. We want to make sure that that's available for all applications, majors as well. So I know, again, it's all about work that's in progress, but we are looking at that at the moment around making sure that we can resource it adequately, but the offer that is available to applicants is a good offer, because obviously it's a paid service. So I would hope soon, I would hope in the next few months we can have that up and running. We have been offering it on a limited basis, but we'd like to offer that across the piece really.
Can we put that onto a future agenda item as well?
Yeah, so
is this part of it?
Yes, it's just following on from that, Madam Chair. With the pre-application service, I've had one brush with it. A local resident put in a pre-application in September last year, 26 weeks ago, and still has not got an answer. Complains that there are long gaps between communications, as if someone has just gone off the radar and then reappeared a few weeks later with a whole lot of new questions. And the same with an application for a lawful development certificate elsewhere. Again, September last year, again, long gaps in communications. And I think if you pay for the service, especially a pre-application service, you kind of imagine, well, this might shorten the process a little bit, but he was left wondering, well, I might as well just put the full application in the first place, because it's 26 weeks and still no answer.
Because what it should do is to make the validation process an awful lot...
Iron out the wrinkles.
Iron out the wrinkles, that's the word. And yet our validation service is going backwards, not forwards. So a good pre-app is going to be so important. We'll hear from the Cabinet Member on it.
Can you get me the case numbers for those two? Because there'll be a really nice way of looking into, was there a problem with the case, a problem with the person, a problem with our process and our validation checklist and our way of doing pre-apps. I will follow up with Lucy in this case.
Yeah,
I'll call in with her early next week, so get me that. And I'll have a little deep dive with her on that. There are improvements that we've got. We talked to some of the agents this week, and we've got some ideas from them about what we could do differently, and we've got some thoughts for them and others about what they can do differently. And one of the most important things is to help people get it right first time, iron out the wrinkles, but make sure those applications, when they come in, it doesn't keep going backwards and forwards to try and, you know, add a report here, a sound report there, a diagram, whatever. If everyone gets it right first time, this will go a lot smoother. We're not there and they're not there.
Okay, thank you.
So that's another one for our future, because pre-app's so important and it's really not working yet. We've introduced it, but it's ineffective.
Okay.
Carry on.
Okay, so page 8, there's an extract from the climate change priority there, which, not much to say, I think the biodiversity net gain guidance note that was produced some time ago. Yep. Key performance indicators, so we go to page 10, just to note on the planning, and again, follows from the previous discussion really, Chair, but major applications performance in quarter three was 80%, so that's pretty good, and above the target of 60. Non-major planning applications, we saw a dip in quarter three, which was lower than we would have liked, obviously at 46.7%. I think, as I explained at the agents meeting yesterday, obviously in that quarter we did see a large number of decisions issued of older applications that were out of time or we haven't secured an extension of time. So We haven't got the quarter four figures obviously yet, but the January figures were certainly better, and I'm confident by the end of quarter four we'll be certainly in a better place than quarter three. Obviously the target being 70%, which we usually would achieve. Okay, so I think that's
completed.
Yep, thank you.
Anybody got any questions on the Dean's report?
Chair, what I understand there were a lot of out of time decisions.
Right.
So based on the improvement plan work that we're doing at the moment, we're trying to reduce the backlog. We were taking those decisions on really old applications,
right,
and we were either refusing them or approving them. So I think it was a big dip. The figures were better in January, so I think by the end of quarter four we'll be better where we should be.
Okay.
We did call this out, 2 years ago, 18 months ago, we did say there's going to be a point where we're doing so much to try and clear a backlog. When those backlog ones get decided, we will have a dip down. We've got to be as good as we can up until then, so that the average across 2 years keeps us above our 2 year target. That's the long term goal. But we knew this would be a drag at some point because there's some old stuff just needed sorting, and Q3 is when that happens.
Thanks. So we're moving on now to the conservation and heritage stuff, and very welcome to Jenny and Sam.
Good evening, everyone. It'll be a bit of a double act between myself and our conservation officer, Sam. So the report is in front of you. As you can see, the actual report is quite light on details, just setting out our heritage assets. However, if you look at Appendix 1, you will see a number of questions that members have previously asked, of which Sam has taken the time to respond.
Page
21. I don't know if you want to go through each question one by one, or if there is anything specific you would like to discuss. Obviously, there are quite a few questions, so I'll leave it open.
Should we go through each one briefly, one by one, Sam?
Yeah.
Just to get a flavour of how you deal with these heritage applications and issues, and what's your thinking when you're measuring the value of an asset in the borough?
Yeah, no problem. So if we start with one of the questions brought up was, does SVC have an up-to-date register of identified heritage assets, historic assets. We as a council don't hold that. That's actually held by Historic England, the National Heritage List for England. They're responsible for all listed buildings, designating them and keeping the register of them, as well as registered parks and gardens, registered battlefields, sacred monuments. We keep a list of our conservation areas, which are also designated heritage assets. Those are all available on our website. So whilst we don't have an in-house list of designated heritage assets, they are kept elsewhere on Historic England's website as the people who hold that. We don't have, for non-designated heritage assets, we don't have a local list at present. So we do not have a defined criteria or a list of non-designated heritage assets in the borough. So that's buildings that are not listed, not scheduled, just nice old buildings basically, that could be considered as part of the planning process. So we're identifying those kind of buildings, forgive the term, on the fly. So as and when we receive a planning application, it potentially comes across my desk and I'll check the building, see if it has amenity value, high levels of character and appearance, historic features, that sort of thing, makes a contribution locally. If it does, it's probably going to meet the criteria for a non-designated heritage asset and it's identified at that point. There is an issue with that process. Whilst it is an accepted process under the planning practice guidance, it's it's not ideal. A lot of councils do have local heritage lists of their own, and they produce supplementary planning documents with a criteria for how we assess those. It is normally done on a nomination basis by members of the public, by parish councils, amenity societies, local historic and civic societies. With not having a formal local heritage list, it does mean that we can't defend a decision for the demolition of a non-designated heritage asset as strongly. We can to a point, but it's quite a weak argument. If that went to appeal and that was the only reason for refusal, it's sketchy ground. So I can identify non-designated heritage assets, yes, through the planning procedure, but unfortunately it's not a very robust argument.
Can we just interrupt there and say, why don't we have a local heritage list?
It's something that's been brought up by several conservation officers in the past, going back to Pennington Knight's time.
Yeah, and it's been brought up by members.
It has,
time
and
time.
It's just unfortunately never gained any traction. I'm not entirely sure why. I think it's probably the resourcing involved, I would imagine. It would require a fair bit of resources to create that criteria. Although we could template it from other councils' criteria locally. A lot of the Staffordshire councils, Lichfield, Newcastle, they've all got those criteria, and they're all very much the same. So we could kind of...
And other authorities use volunteers, the local
very
civic
often,
societies, to do the work.
You are required to maintain your local heritage list. You are meant to review it.
Yeah.
Every so often, so there is a responsibility for a council that has one, but ultimately it will be useful, I think, to us.
Do you want to add before Brian comes in?
To do a local list, we would have to see it through the local plan process. It would have to be a locally designated policy, and obviously we are currently in the sort of beginning terms of trying to get the new plan up and running, so it is something we can look at as part of that piece of work. But we would need a robust evidence base to ensure that we can defend it at the public inquiry.
What do people think?
I think it's very important.
Yeah.
I think it's really important.
So,
some
really other action, Jackie.
I mean, why would Lichfield have one and we don't? It doesn't make sense.
We are the only borough council, district council in Staffordshire without one.
Yeah.
Well,
right.
More reason to have one then, really.
So, just to explain again, both of you, what it would have to go through the local plan process. We need to spend money on producing the evidence, but a lot of this evidence could be brought together by the local civic and historic societies who've got it already available.
As part of any criteria, we would have to... We could have nominations from anybody, essentially.
Sure.
But we'd have to go through each nomination to ensure it met said criteria that we've set. So there is an element on our side as well. Whilst we can get nominations from the public, we still have to assess each individual case.
And would you have to bring in consultants to do that, or have you got the capacity?
At any time, that's the problem.
Obviously, you'll see in the report we have 29 conservation areas. Guidance does indicate that we should be updating anything to do with the conservation area appraisal to the management plans every 5 years. There is a cost associated with that. Obviously, we only have one conservation officer available who has to deal with any of the applications that fall within a listed building or a conservation area. So there would be a resource implication.
There always is, so
yeah.
But that shouldn't be a reason not to do it.
So
right, but let's have the cabinet member who's going to make it happen.
Dean will vouch for this. It was the first meeting I had with Dean. I brought up local lists.
Yeah.
We've also talked about, do we need more conservation areas? Are there parts of town that you and I agree really should be having that? So what I'm asking my conservation officer to do is also review every single application and make sure that the responses we've got are heavily evidenced so that we can defend heritage and conservation assets properly, and looking at, you know, nearly 30 sites that haven't been looked at for 10 years, and making sure that there are local decisions being made in there, that each of the conservation areas nowadays will need to be customised to local needs. I'm asking too much, and I know that Sam really wants to do all of this. And so it's okay to pick and choose. Now, I've got agreement with Jenny and Alex that we will do the local list and we'll do the other stuff as soon as we've got the resources, as soon as Dean's found the magic button that releases some of the planning backlog and the planning delays that allows us to do this. Absolutely committed to it, but I'm nearly 3 years in and we haven't got there yet.
I think we need a recommendation from this committee to at least to introduce the local heritage list, but to do all the other work as well. So it's important. I mean, I suppose our starting point is the dreadful demolition of buildings that's taken place in this borough, which has been absolutely shocking. The way the brine baths were taken down, nearly took down the High House. I mean, we can't trash our heritage in the way that we obviously do. We've got to treasure it, and it's we can always say we've got a resource problem, but the resources that are put into protecting our heritage are going to make a difference to the picture that people have of our towns and the reason they want to come into our towns to run their businesses or to come and visit. They don't want to come into towns where we've taken out our lovely buildings and removed the beautiful landscapes. So to me, it's one of the most important things that we could possibly be doing.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I was shocked.
Fran, yes.
Yeah, I just wondered, has Lorraine Conkey's organisation, in fact, have organised a Stafford History Day, I think, on the 28th of this month? Has she been liaising with you about...
She's not contacted me. No, I am aware of the History Day on the 28th, and I know they do a lot of Howie House and they do walking heritage trails.
I think it's the county archivists that do
yeah.
it, not Lorraine.
Yeah, it's the LR Partnership, I think, that's...
Well, she's publicising it, but it's run by County Council. They do it every year.
Because it includes a lot of the heritage.
And it's an absolutely great thing, yeah. It's fantastic.
I think we should start the work to create this list.
Mm-hmm. So, just thinking, when the young lady started, I thought, well, a list, it's a piece of paper. I thought it meant there's a lot of expense involved, there's a lot of money. We haven't got the money, so we'd leave it on one side and something gets knocked down. So it's a pity we haven't got the money to save the brine baths. Never mind, we move on to other things. And I accept that it's always the money and the money's wrong. But I thought we must have some of the piece of paper with some things written on. But you can't keep a list because you've got to have the money to do all these works that you've explained. I understand all of that, you know. What a pity. Somewhere we haven't got a little list. I don't send anybody in the drawer here, but a list. I've got a list of things that ought to be done. When we have the money, or when we get the
Sam
money.
Does have that list.
I'm sure she does.
It's on page 22 of your
report. And all her predecessors have had it
so
as
we
well.
That's what I was worried about. They hadn't got a list. Somebody said, well, by the way, there's a plan application coming up, and it's got a couple of things in there on your list. Well, let's do something. Let's get something done. And,
It would be useful to sit down and have a meeting to see all the things that might be possible and are totally impossible. Presumably that's something that the scrutiny committee can do with you, because we can't even begin to touch on it at a meeting like this. We just need to sit down and see what the art of the possible is, and cabinet member as well, so that we can get an idea of whether we're barking up paths that are waste of time.
I'd be happy to do some sort of like workshop or something like that, where we can have that kind of discussion sort of thing. So, or a meeting.
I think something of a workshop would be very useful.
Mm. Chair, reading the room, is the committee advising Cabinet and Dean that we should be prioritising resources to support activities like the local list, as well as the conservation areas and the criteria? It's a lot of work. There's a lot of effort needed there.
It is.
But if the committee is advising us to look at that and find any resources, we need to take that back and do that.
We need, yeah, that's what Jack is making a note of, and that's what we will certainly be recommending, because I think we've just agreed that. But more than that, I think we'd like a workshop to understand what the work involves and how much is within the art of the possible if resources were available. Because resources are made available because there's a dramatic need for those resources. The point I try to make is that there's a real economic need to preserve our beautiful buildings and our beautiful curtilages, because it adds to the value of our towns. If we keep demolishing buildings, I mean, we're made to keep the front of the Guildhall up, good thing. We can't just keep knocking everything down and hope that by looking like Milton Keynes, we're doing a great job. With great respect to Milton Keynes.
Could I ask, what was the response from members? Did many members take part in the question about what do members think about heritage sites of the National? Sorry,
sir. Sorry, when was that asked? We were asked
to participate in our thoughts about heritage sites. And we ask questions about are there any current undesignated heritage sites that can be upgraded?
Yes.
Oh,
should
I
do
these?
Yeah, no, that's fine.
So, how many councillors put questions in?
I think four or five.
Because we nominated, I can't tell off the top of my head, but it was about four or five members put questions in. It wasn't a huge amount. Mm-hmm. And I think some members asked multiple questions as well.
Yes, keep going.
So we're on to the historic assets listed, not listed, one of most at risk through neglect, decay or other threats. There are actual lists for this. So we've got the formal list kept by Historic England, their heritage at risk register. That only includes Grade 2 star and Grade 1 listed buildings and scheduled monuments, registered parks and guards of conservation areas. It doesn't include Grade 2, and Grade 2 are the majority of listed buildings. They account for about 92% of listed buildings. So that list is detailed in Appendix 1 and in that question of everything that's on Historic England's heritage register presently for Staffordshire. We actually don't have that many, which is good. It's relatively small compared to many other areas, so we're doing quite well on that front. Safe Britain's Heritage is another, it is more of an informal one because they are a campaign group, but they're a very well-renowned campaign group. They keep a buildings at risk register. Stafford Borough does have several on there. Again, not too many, and that does include Grade 2 and non-designated heritage assets on that list, as well as the Grade 1s and the Grade 2 stars. So that list's also present. And then I also keep an informal list myself, just to keep an eye on certain buildings that I've been monitoring and are concerned about. That is a bit longer. But I am obviously more familiar with the area than Historic England and Safe Britain's Heritage. So my list is included. That list is not made public simply because it's got a lot of personal information on there about particular people who own those properties, and informal discussions had with those people, so we don't publish that. But there are 26 entries on my in-house list at present, which are all listed on there. I do monitor those, do site visits on them, try to do it annually where possible. Some of them aren't as easy to access, those ones are what I've got at the moment. There will be many more that aren't on that list. We've got a lot of old buildings in Stafford Borough, and it's just as and when I identify them that I add that onto that informal heritage at risk register.
Doug?
Why are the three lists different to each other?
Some of them do cross over.
Yes,
you'll
see
that
there's
a cross over.
Historic
England is for their designated heritage assets, so that's dealing with your listed buildings and all the other types of designated heritage assets. but they don't include grade two, which accounts for most listed buildings. So they only deal with the higher level listings. Whereas, say, Britain's Heritage, like I said, they're a campaign group.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more informal. They take nominations from the public. It's not as a formal procedure. They do take nominations from myself as well. They contact me every year asking for updates. So I do that annually with them. Got 9 entries on there at the minute. But that was grade two. There are crossovers with the grade two star and the grade ones as well, but they also do non-designated heritage assets. And then my own list is my own in-house list that I...
Yes, it kind of feels like the save one, in my head, it seems broader and therefore would theoretically automatically include all of the other ones already.
I have put forward to save everything that's on there, but they have their own assessment criteria well, which I don't control, but I have put everything that's on ours to save. And that is publicly available as well online.
But not all the ones that are on the other two are on your internal one.
I think most of them are. I haven't. Sometimes I don't bother including the grade two stars and the grade ones because they are on Historic England's formal register. Mine's very much an informal list of ones that I'm keeping an eye on. Generally in contact with a lot of these people as well. But yeah, most of mine are grade two on the internal list. There is the odd grade two star on there as well.
And Sam, you'd focus on the built environment, whereas the...
And conservation areas. We do have a couple of conservation areas on Historic England's Heritage Register.
So your list focuses on...
My in-house list is buildings and structures.
That's
right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I've noticed that Siphon Hall is on one but not the other.
Yeah,
Siphon Hall won't be on Historic England's. It's included on Saves.
Yeah, I can't see it on the internal one.
To be honest, it's been such a long, that's a 25-year project. all the conservation officers have been involved in. So I think it was just a given that you inherited that one. But it's definitely on the radar. are there currently any undesignated heritage assets that can be upgraded to a heritage asset? How long is the piece of string, I suppose? There's lots of non-designated heritage assets in the borough. Not all of them are going to meet the standard, but it's as and when I come across buildings that I think meet the listing criteria set by Historic England, I make an application to Historic England as and when I identify those buildings. I do have to provide evidence. It isn't a simple case of saying, here's the building. It is a bit of a drawn-out procedure. It does take quite a bit of time because you have to provide an evidence base for every application to Historic England. But I do identify, as and when I come across them, I do apply for listing status where I think they meet that criteria set by Historic England.
Would the County Council building on Martin Street be classed as a conservation item or a heritage asset because it's a beautiful building?
The county buildings are all listed, they've all got listed status, and they're in
no,
the conservation area. They're in the conservation area as well, so they're pretty well protected, those ones.
Thank you. Chairman, is there what you've just said, when you have a building and you put it to them, is there a sort of a list of things that it has to qualify?
Yes, it's a very stringent criteria.
But is it written down somewhere?
Yes, it's on Historic England's website. They have a guide on there, the criteria.
But we could look at it.
Yes,
we find it?
It's just Historic England's website. They have a lot of guides on there, but if you want me to send you the link to the specific guide, happy to do that.
As some of our members of Parish Council, I'm sure if we knew such a thing was available, we could start looking. And
anyone can apply for but it's naturally worth checking the criteria because you don't. It's a lot of time and effort sometimes to put in an application for listening. So
there are just some people locally in all our areas, I'm sure, who are quite happy to spend hours doing these things.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm not signing up for this. I'm just suggesting that my hobby.
I know
you. Cabinet members who might have a couple of hours.
I can absolutely send that to you. That's not a problem.
Thank you very much.
I've requested in the past, not through this meeting, but informally, to have listed the control tower at Hickson Airfield, which dates from 1942. It's in good nick, it's been well looked after over the years, but when I've approached it in the past, the owners have said we don't want it listed. Can they do that?
They are consulted. So once, if you, anyone can submit an application for listing on anything, regardless of ownership. That goes to Historic England to assess. They do ask that you provide the contact details of the owner where they are available. And Historic England will then consult the owner and ask for their opinion on the matter. I don't know the weighting of that decision within Historic England. I have known buildings be listed completely against the owner's wishes. I know several recent examples. So they will list it if it meets their criteria. But yes, they do consult the owners. The owners do have their say.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that in the past, when I requested it, the ownership has now changed. It's now owned by Bet 365. So whether they might be open to a punt or not, I don't know.
Set a campaign coming on.
I remember you mentioning at planning one time about the old shoe factories around.
I'm about to come up to that.
Oh,
one. Yes. Sam is well aware.
That's really interesting because it really is part of our heritage,
yeah.
And it should be a conservation area.
Should we raise it now, Sam?
The
starting point is this, that I was approached again when I was cabinet member, I think, a while back, to introduce some kind of protection for the dwellings and the little factory sites along Sandon Road, Marston Road and so on, which were all part and parcel of Lotus. And the shoe tradition goes back a long way in Stafford. We had shoemakers within the town. We had allied industries, which Bostick now is probably the one of the best examples, when the glue was produced. And the dyeing industry and so on. It's a huge heritage for the town, which has in lots of ways been forgotten. So this group got together and suggested that we create a conservation area around Sandon Road, Marston Road and so on. And I've put a lot of work in. It includes the protection of the Sandonia building, which was threatened with being pulled down. We sort of got to a point when I think, and it started with Alan Taylor, Sam took over, and I'm not sure where it's got to, so I pass over to you now, Sam, to see what the situation is.
So at the time, I believe it was Karen Tierney who was head of service.
She was, yeah.
He was reading. So it was.
Dean may not be aware of it at all.
He is.
I'm aware of it. No, I am not.
But so it was raised with Karen Tierney at the time, who had shown a level of support for it, but unfortunately, she obviously went off for quite a substantial amount of time after that. And so that was one of the delays in that process at that point. And then Dean came on board a little later, and there was a lot going on, I think, when he first started. So, yeah, COVID and things like that. There was lots of delays.
The backlog.
The biggest barrier to the assessment of this as a conservation area is definitely the lack of resource the conservation has. Again, this would be, at the minute, there's just me. If we were to consider a shoe quarter conservation area in that part of town, it would require financial investment and resources. And I think with a backlog of 29 conservation area appraisals that need reviewing, it's what are we prioritising? Are we prioritising the review of our existing conservation areas, which are some of them are significantly out of date. We're quite beyond our 5-year target for those on most of them. I think most of them are at least 10 years.
Some
are going
back quite
a few
decades.
Your
last local plan was the last
time
it was really done
comprehensively.
Yeah, no, I'm well aware.
And obviously with the potential now prospect of a local list being a potential priority as well, I think it's just...
Are you saying I'm asking too much?
He's trying to manage expectations.
We all want to do this.
Yes, we absolutely do. As a conservation officer, and this is my opinion, I do think that it has potential, definitely. But I think it's a case of there are other priorities at the moment, and unless we can provide additional resources, something's got
to
give.
Yeah, just to say, of course, and you're aware of this, that there is a very strong group of individuals and businesses who are behind this project and would put a lot of the legwork in. It seems a shame to dismiss it because we haven't got the resources. It's the inevitable answer that we're always going to get, and in the meantime, the buildings will be lost. Dean is wanting to come in.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Yeah, just to expand on that point, I mean, it is a question of priorities, and we have a lot of priorities. There are a lot of things that we would like to do. We've talked about planning and development management, and obviously a committee have expressed, you know, your frustration with that, and we want to pick up the pace. But it's a priority, and it requires resource, and the council has to operate within the financial environment that it sits within. So I'd just be really clear, as the head of service, I've put forward a number of different budget requests, you know, as I was asked to do, some of which have been agreed and are in the budget, and they will provide us with additional capacity, some of which were not, but they're still priorities, and what we want to do is look at how we can fund those, whether it's through the local plan, in terms of the evidence gathering, which Jenny referred to. But yeah, the existing appraisals need refreshing. That's a priority and a cost. We'd like to look at potential new area. That's a priority, but it's a cost, and so on and so forth. So it is a question of prioritisation. But I'll be really clear, because you know we have talked about this, and you know Sam has been dealing with quite a backlog herself. We bought some additional capacity in to help Sam with that backlog quite recently, and that's really helped. So it's just trying to manage within the environment that we've got here, and unfortunately we can't do everything, but they are priorities, and if we can find a way with the support of the cabinet member, we will look at how we can bring it forward. But we just have to look at how we can't do everything at once. So that's all I wanted to say as head of service.
No, I appreciate that, and the point I keep making is that the voluntary organisations, and you see the wonderful work that was done by the Victorian Society in Birmingham, and we had all those arguments in Birmingham, we haven't got the resource, we can't do it, we're too busy, da 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 da. So the Victorian Society said, we will do it, we will do this work. And what I need to understand is to what extent you can allow them to take over the bulk of the work on our behalf, so that the job gets done, as it were. I appreciate all the points that are being made, but in the meantime, we're at risk of losing. We're very bad on our heritage in this borough. We really are shocking. We don't value it, and we need to put a bit more thought into how we give our best attention to it.
Well, I would say, sorry, maybe a cabinet member.
Sam has got, to turn this around, Sam has got on page 23 an active suggestion on one of the things we can do, which is the heritage champion process. Mm-hmm. And I think a heritage champion, call it a pilot if you like, for this Shoemaker Quarter might well be a way to gather the evidence, get structure in place, get members aware of what's going on and the workload, the sheer workload that's involved in starting it, never mind running with it. That might well be a way that when Sam's work and Jenny's work frees up, sometime this century, right, frees up, that a lot of the body of evidence is already in good shape. Because that's one of my worries, is that if a voluntary group has never done this before and is enthusiastic and gathers it all, what shape is it in when Sam gets to look at it?
I think in this case, well, Sam's help. Aware is it's in very good shape. You've got a very strong organisation there.
So Heritage Champion might well be the way forward. I'll follow up with the team on whether that will move us forward from where.
So long as the Heritage Champion is working with the local volunteers.
Let's explore that together and see what we can do, even if that's a heritage champion that is not necessarily in the council, but is working with the council.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that's right. It needs to be somebody who's involved with the project to take over the heritage champion.
We've got to find a way forward rather than go over past.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, sir.
Just up where it is, it describes it as a member heritage champion. Would that be one of the members?
In the past, I've been, Francis, you've been a heritage champion.
I've been a heritage champion for English heritage.
Yeah.
I think I still am, actually.
It does come from the concept of English heritage, and a lot of councils do allocate. It is normally a member, but I don't think there's anything that strictly says it has to be.
I'm just more thinking we have our appointments meeting, which would where formally something like that would be appointed, is not that far away. So if we need to take an action in order to ensure that that is appointed at that point, then.
And as long as it's somebody who's passionately interested and involved, not just Buggins. Great respect.
Okay, on that theme, we're going down the how yep. members can help in promoting the protection of our heritage sites in their wards and across the borough. So we've already touched on Heritage Champion, which is the top point. And I think we also touched on the supporting of the creation of a local heritage list today, so
uh-huh.
I think we can pretty much tick that one off as well. Promoting heritage in community engagement is a pretty standard thing. I know some members sometimes have newsletters, ward meetings, or forums. It's raising that awareness, really. Specific villages, towns have specific characters, and who's better placed on that than the people living there and the members that represent them. So it's signposting, really, to be honest. There's a lot of information on Historic England's website and supporting appropriate maintenance practices and things like that. They're very simple things. There's a lot of information, and I think mainly it would be just signposting. And if you wanted to learn something yourself in the meantime as well, then by all means. It's doing it at a grassroots level, I think, really, and just planting the seed. There's advocating for policy support and resources. I think we've just touched on that as well. For conservation projects, as well as enforcement, as well as is a big factor in this buildings and heritage. I have a lot of enforcement work, so I work with them regularly, so just supporting that side of it as well is helpful to us, and acting as a liaison between officers and the community and your residents, basically between me and them, enforcement and them, whoever you need to be in touch with, but it all helps cumulatively. So it's just taking that collective approach, I think, is how you guys can help me and help our enforcement team as well. That brings us on to the last point, which looks lengthy. So we're moving on to the concerns were raised about the ownership of historic buildings within the town centre area in particular. Which buildings are historic buildings? What is the state of these buildings? Who's responsible for their upkeep? And how can we, SBC, ensure that the buildings are kept to an acceptable standard? Definition of historic building, I've kind of detailed there. It's a very difficult definition to define. Historic is anything in the past. So generally it refers to traditional construction pre-1919. However, there are some listed buildings that are a lot younger than that.
Yeah.
So it all comes down to historic interest, architectural interest, and archaeological interest. It's a very broad definition, and there's lots of factors involved in it. I've tried to explain it as best I can in that bullet point there. Current state of the buildings in the town centre is very varied. We've got some that are very well looked after, and we've got some that are in pretty poor states of repair. But unfortunately, the responsibility for those buildings, whether listed or unlisted, is with the owners. And there is no statutory requirement to keep a listed building in a state of good repair. We can't control that. it's up to the owners to look after and maintain their buildings. We can, where we think a building is at immediate risk, particularly a listed building, there are mechanisms that the council have to get involved in that, but it would literally have to be, it's a very high bar, and we can't, if it's just looking a bit shabby, that's not going to be good enough for us to step in. It would have to be where we've got major water ingress issues, collapsing, structural problems, it's that kind of level, and we can do that through the formal procedures such as urgent works notices and section 215 notices in certain circumstances. However, I've had quite a lot of success with sending letters to people, to be honest. If I've got the owner's contact details, I can email them, or I can send a letter to the properties if they're occupied. And generally speaking, I've had quite a reasonable response where I've tried to engage with that owner and they've then come back. I've told them my concerns about their building, and then very often they do respond. And then it starts the dialogue. It's very expensive to repair these buildings.
Yeah.
They're very specialist in a lot of circumstances. And so it's taking that kind of initially a light touch approach and just making contact. If you're not getting anything back after several letters, that's when we can start considering a more formal action. But to be honest, I do have a generally reasonable response from private owners for their listed buildings and encouraging them to repair them. So that is again something I do in the background. It's not something that people are aware of necessarily, but it does happen in the background. So whilst we do have a list of at-risk buildings here, quite a few have been removed in the past couple of years from my own internal list through just letters and communicating with owners alone and subsequent planning listed buildings and applications moving forward. So we do have formal powers, yes. They should only be a last resort.
And thanks very much. Anybody got any more questions for Sam? In that case,
thank you, Chairman, for a comprehensive report.
Yeah. And enthusiasm as well.
Yeah. Thank you very much indeed, Sam, for that presentation. Thank you, Jenny, as well, for supporting her.
Can I just ask, how often does this review take place? Annually or what?
Which review, sorry?
What we've done, the process that we've just gone through.
Us?
Yes.
We put it on the agenda because of our general concern at the state of some of our buildings and because of my...
It's not an annual event.
No, it's when we think that there's a need. Because we tend to focus on so many other things and heritage sort of flies out of our minds somehow.
It's a very interesting topic.
It's important, but thank you both for that contribution.
Sorry, Dan, stop it. The date of 1919, sort of construction prior to, does that change ever? Or is that a rolling date? Or is it?
No, it's the point where it's around the time that we started seeing cavity wall as a construction method being brought in, so it doesn't change. cavity wall was before then, but it was at that point it became more of a throughout the country, but before they were solid wall construction. Okay. So that's why we use 1919 as a guide for historic.
Thank you. We've got all sorts of actions that are
Thank you, Chair. I was just going to say that actually, probably we've made a note of what you agreed, but obviously there was clearly recommendation there around priorities. I think the offer from Sam of that sort of workshop would be more than happy to facilitate.
Yes,
that.
Please, very much appreciated.
And we're more than happy to bring this back. You know, whether you want to look at it in the future, maybe a year's time, but can come back to it as and when the committee wants, Chair. It is an important topic.
Even less than a year, maybe.
Yeah. So maybe not July, but you know, it'll be a long meeting and not a lot of time. But perhaps we
might look at it at the beginning of the new year,
yeah.
As a January meeting, perhaps.
Good.
That's right. Thank you very much. And we now move on to planning enforcement policy, the old favourite.
Well, a Another easy one.
Who's this? Social, this is you. This is your
down.
This is your moment.
Thank you, Chair.
So you're updating us.
Yes, I'll, I'm just going to bring you through this enforcement policy. Right, just by way of background, just to explain what the enforcement policy is looking to deliver and the reasons why they're bringing it in. So, the council had an enforcement policy that dated back to 2015, so it's quite old,
yeah.
And it needed updating. And the point of having the policy is to basically set out the local standards in terms of types of cases that the council will take on and where we potentially would take in terms of enforcement action, but also manage some of the expectations and workload. Now, enforcement is not a, a statutory service, but it does have a high profile, and you know, certainly seen in Stafford, there is a lot of demand for that service. So, the planning team, obviously, our role is to regulate development, to make sure that development carries out has got the appropriate consents in place. A lot of the time, breaches are reported to us, and then we need to make an assessment on whether that breach requires action. Some breaches we won't pursue, and again, the details of that are within the policy, so we need to set that out. For example, if somebody's built some boundary fencing and it's 5 centimetres higher than 2 metres, we say it's not in the public interest to pursue that. It doesn't justify enforcement action in that case. For other breaches, certainly we would pursue. So we've got options there. Either we take them through and try and resolve them through negotiation, and a lot of times that does work. But the other end of the stick, in effect, is then taking formal enforcement action, which could result in basically taking them to court and fines imposed. So, as I mentioned, planning enforcement is to remedy undesirable effects of unauthorised development and bring that unauthorised activity under control, so the planning system is not undermined. So, as I say, we wanted to bring in a policy that was, as best as we could, make it as transparent as possible, it could be interpreted by users and people making complaints. So we set some standards in terms of the level of information that we need on a complaint and what is a breach. Now, the information provided from the complaint is held safely, it's confidential, but sometimes we do need to follow through on a complaint. We will need to speak to that individual, but their identity is never disclosed at that point. So moving on to the policy, it is quite a complicated policy. I don't think it's not that easy to explain, but in effect, it's a two-stage process. So looking at the tables in front of you, so the first part of it is to look at the the breach has been reported, and what we're looking to do is to score the breach. And the best way of doing this really is to use an example. It's through those examples that we can illustrate how the policy will be applied. So we use an example whereby that we took the case that there was a tidy land, that it's caused an issue for more than 6 months, and there's a highway issue involved as well. And when you follow that through the matrix, so the first table, it's low one, it's got 1 point. We mentioned that it's been excluded for 6 months. So that would score another point. And then there's also highway safety. So that would get 2 points. So that initial assessment will then get it over the bar to then take it forward to investigation. And at that point, we suggest a score of 3. Then beyond that point, it's then taken through into an expediency assessment. So we're saying that anything that scores four or more is likely to be considered. Anything below three, we would normally recommend that no action is taken. And that on the basis of, and then in terms of taking that case forward, we then have to score the harm that's caused on the breach, which then leads into, and you can see that there's no harm, low harm, up to significant harm, and there's a definition for that for those as well. And then moving on, once you've got the scoring and you assess the harm, it then leads into the basic time scales involved for the investigation. So anything that's got a high priority would be investigated within 1 to 2 days. Coming down to something that's a low priority, which would be 20 days for a site visit and initial assessment to be carried out. And then further on the policy, we then talk about how breaches are resolved, the methods that we can use, and that ranges from negotiation through to formal prosecution. And the last point there comes in the direct action, which is where the council could basically use these powers, carry out the work in default, and then put the charge against the property. And that's an action that we're looking at the moment. So, at the moment, we haven't applied the policy, we're not using it just yet, and we're intending to start on the 1st of April. We're hoping that the case files for the enforcement team would allow that to happen. Case files are still very, very high, but we're still looking to get it in before the 1st of April. This has been developed in conjunction with Mondra, who's been working with the planning team with the improvement plan. And the next stage of work that we really want them to do, we've asked them to Mondra to help us to illustrate the policy and put some real life examples, so we can put it on the website to provide further guidance to users. So we just want that information to come through. And really, I would not want to implement the policy before that information is on the website, because it will just cause confusion otherwise, but still targeting April to go ahead with this.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions?
Yeah, where would it come? Where the structure's put up, goes to appeal, the inspector then says remove the structure. How would you class that? What degree would you class that?
Yeah, that falls into the formal route then. So once an appeal's been determined, because normally if there's a breach, we'd ask for the breach to be resolved, and you know, they can at that point put a planned application in, as you know, and council may refuse it, goes to appeal. But we would pause enforcement action up until that planned application is determined. That's what best practice
yeah.
The guardians tells us to do. But once that appeal is determined, you know, we've got powers then.
Because it's over 18 months since this inspector gave that decision and nothing's happened. Nothing has gone too bad in the past.
I followed up on it. I'll check my notes on that, but I'm pretty sure that toward the end of 2025 we got something back from someone on that.
We never got an enforcement officer to actually go there, I think, or it hadn't the last time.
I've seen an update, I think, so I will check the notes. But that would be on page 40 to 41. There's already something there, so we would be pursuing action before 42, whatever it was.
Just on that point, so the enforcement team, we've got three agency enforcement planners with us. They joined February, so we've had a bit of turnover with the enforcement team. So there's been a period where we really haven't had much of a service that we've delivered. So we've brought Sarah Locker in, and she's the she leads the enforcement team. She's got two other people, John Langdown and Samuel Cole, working with her. Now, hopefully, if you've used enforcement service, you've come across them, and kind of, you know, got your own experience of the way they work. But as I say, it's fully resource team. They were in till their contracts were to March, but we're extending them on to keep them to obviously address the backlog of application.
Okay. Anybody got any questions on this paper? We
I'm going to retain this document.
Yeah. Yeah. And we. And you're happy to note the recommendation, the policy. Thank you very much. That moves us on to the work programme, and we've added a whole lot of things to it, haven't we, Jackie?
Well, yeah. Hopefully, Jackie's noted all of the items, but I think yes, we haven't got the dates of the meetings yet, but. We've got quite a number of items for the July meeting. We've also got the joint meeting.
Just refer to the joint meeting, remind members?
Yeah, 31st of March, joint meeting with the Resources Scrutiny Committee to look at Section 106, which is everyone's favourite subject. But we'll provide a paper and a presentation around current position on Section 106 and... So work that we're doing, obviously, to look at how we can utilise those funds. And then I think in terms of July, we've got some items, a local plan, town centre development framework.
Have you got the other ones there, Jack?
It's Station Gateway.
So can I ask this Section 106 meeting, is that for the whole council?
Anybody can come, yes. It's the Resources and Economic Scrutiny Committee meeting, joint meeting, but anybody is invited. Barry's invited as well.
Can I report a huge success on Section 106?
Yes.
Oh, save it for the 31st.
I'm doing it on Saturday this week. We're opening a brand new artificial turf cricket pitch in Hickson from Section 106. We haven't got a cricket ground, but we've provided the pitch for bowling or batting with a net enclosure.
Build it and they will come.
Yeah.
Well, it all shows how the persistence of the ward member pays dividends eventually.
You
got me quite excited. They mentioned a huge success in 106. I thought it would be that for all of us.
I was hoping Cherry would say that for the first time.
What are the additional items?
Jackie, one of them's moved from July, which is the gateway. We're moving it from July to September.
Yeah.
So gateway, because there's nothing to report on it at the moment. There were one or two that were coming in. It'll be in the minutes anyway, won't it? It'll be in the minutes. So the work programme is full for the rest of the year, and we look forward to seeing everybody at the next meeting, which is March the 31st.
It's the 31st, a full meeting. Do I need to send neither myself nor Councillor Carter, who is on resources, will be in the...
I think it's a formal meeting, but
right.
It's not one that you need to substitute particularly.
Okay.
Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, and we'll be able to circulate papers and presentations.
Yeah, it's just to really update on Section 106. Thank you very much for your attendance, everyone, and looking forward to seeing you in March.